Okay, so let's maybe start the last item on the program for today, which is a discussion panel. So with the organizers, we thought that it's fun to have other things than talks, that they're, this way we can discuss like about everything. So in the panel, the people that we will be free to ask questions and who will somehow give us their brains on things, we have Kyle Kremer, one of the organizers of the conference. We have Roger Melko, one of the organizers of the Machine 19 program. Miles Studenmaier, another organizer of the Machine 19 program. Giulio Biroli, organizer of the Landscape 19 program. And Kieran Burke, whom you heard talking this morning.
Organizer.
We wanted also to have a representative from industry, but she's only coming in tomorrow. Okay, so we are one person less. That's fine. So I thought, I somehow thought that I have like maybe four questions that I would like to know what you think about them, and then, or maybe fewer if it is long, and then we will ask the audience like questions that they have on mind on the really on broadly between machine learning and physics. So my first question, I hope you will not be annoyed with me straight ahead, is like the success stories. Like we are here, we heard some amazing success stories of the DFT this morning, but if we should restrict it to the interface between physics and machine learning, and you should pick one or say something about, I don't know, maybe we don't need success stories, whatever, what would you say? You can start in any order.
Okay, I'll start. We discussed this question in kind of the informal discussion session of our program last Friday. I think there's kind of two answers to that, or maybe two other questions you can ask. Why do you need success stories is one thing that I think I raised. I myself and Matthew Fisher, I think, also pointed out the fact that like in our field, it's condensed matter, quantum information theory, combined with machine learning. It's kind of a very young, I believe, dynamic crowd of interested people just exploring things. And so one point is maybe that's enough, if you have an enthusiastic group of people. But I think to be concrete, to actually answer the question, I'd say one of the most exciting things in our field that is like, again, I would say on the condensed matter side, perhaps, is the rapid adoption of supervised learning techniques basically directly into experiment. So we developed as a community several sort of proof of principle examples of how supervised learning can be used to, I guess process data. The group at Cornell, I know Frank's in the audience, I just saw him walk in, and Una Kim is giving a talk, is it Thursday? She'll talk about how basically supervised learning was very rapidly incorporated into experimental discovery in sort of, STM experiments and so on. That's one big success. And I know also Marcus Greiner's experiment on basically cold atoms, which is reproducing sort of an effective Hubbard model, one of the holy grails in our field. Is now being looked at with supervised learning. And actually what they're doing is categorizing different theories for correlation functions. So this is something that conceptually went, very quickly from sort of theory into experiment, and I think it's one of the biggest successes that we've seen so far in our subfield.
So in particle physics, we've been using machine learning and neural network things since kind of the late 80s. So it's been around for a long time, but there's always been kind of a certain level of skepticism. So it goes back and forth between some areas where it's used and accepted and some areas where people don't want to do it. And usually that's a statement of how much do you gain, because there's usually some kind of traditional method. And oftentimes what we see is that it's a, depending on how you count, something like 30% improvement or maybe a factor of two or something, but it's not making things that are, totally revolutionary in some sense. But if you turn that into the amount of data that you need for equivalent results, it's a lot more data, and our data is very expensive, so it's definitely a win. But we've been kind of living with that win for a while, so we're kind of used to it. I think right now there's a lot of desire to try to see something that's qualitatively different. And what's, I think, exciting about deep learning is that there are so many things beyond sort of classification and regression problems that are possible now that there's a lot of hope that we'll be able to do something like really, really different. I think it's a different type of success, but one of the things that's happening recently now, I think, is that you're starting to see a lot of really novel ideas about how to integrate what we know, like the domain knowledge and what we know about physics into the machine learning models. And some first examples of being able to sort of do some sort of learning where you can still interpret parts of the model in a kind of traditional sense. So I think that's, to me, like a lot of the, is in a meta level, one of the successes is starting to figure out a way that you can kind of mix machine learning, the power of machine learning with the kind of traditional way that we've thought about doing the science.
I think, yeah, just building on that too, I would say it doesn't have to be kind of an all or nothing comparison, like what worked better, quantum Monte Carlo or machine learning? 100% that, 100% that. You know, it could be that, like, for example, there's two posters that I saw out in the lobby that I think highlight a good way of blending these ideas, and they both kind of have the flavor of like accelerating or bypassing certain expensive parts of Monte Carlo algorithms. So one of them is from the group of Lei Wang, who unfortunately couldn't be here this week. But the idea is something like using these normalizing flow ideas from machine learning. So it's really just borrowing like a math concept or like a tool to find a better basis to do Monte Carlo sampling in. And another one is by, it's like Or Sharir and Yoav Levin and Giuseppe Carleo, speeding up or sort of bypassing expensive sampling parts in variational optimizations of web wave functions. So I encourage you to look at those kind of examples of blending nice ideas from both fields together and kind of getting a better than both combination.
So, well, actually, in my field, which is more classical statistical physics, I would say that I think the really the success is ahead, but there is really a lot of excitement, and I think it's just a question of time. And just to give you an example, I gave 1 year ago a challenge in data science at Ecole Normale, and the challenge was you do a simulation of a liquid close to the glass transition, I mean, when it's very slow. You give the initial condition, then you run the dynamics, so you give the initial condition of the particle, and then you give the final position. So you know what are the particles that moved. So you feed this into a deep network, and then you want that the network, if you give some kind of initial condition, it's able to tell you what are the particles that I'm going to move in a very distant future. So in a certain sense, it has to learn Newton equation if you want, but actually it has to learn what are the interesting feature in the structure, the initial condition to predict long-time dynamics. And now the incredible thing is that the student that did it, they were students from applied math, so they had a good basis in physics, but not, I mean, it's a professional basis. And they discover, just doing this challenge, things that have been discovered, I mean, on which physicists work in the last 10 years. So they discover what is called dynamical heterogeneity, so that particles move together in a glass close to the glass transition. So that was incredibly, was amazing. Of course, well, if it arrived 10 years ago, this would have been a big success. So this is just an example that I think there is really a lot of success in discovering new phenomena, which is ahead of us.
I don't have any.
Well, I can tell you one, but it won't be very popular. Like a success story, and it's not to do with the machine learning. But when I think about this DFT stuff and how it became very widespread and popular, the key event that I regard as important is in the early 90s, quantum chemists had spent a long time doing something really boring. They created a data set and they tested this data. They were testing traditional quantum chemistry methods. And it's called a G2 data set. And they had to pin down experimental numbers to within less than about 0.1 kilocalorie per mole, a very, very high level of accuracy. And then they tested their ability to solve the Schrodinger equation on these sort of small molecules. And it took them years and years. It's very hard to get the energetics that accurately. And this data set existed. And in 1993, a bunch of thoughtful quantum chemists said, well, this DFT stuff is getting better. We'll try it out on this data set. And because they knew the experimental numbers and the calculational numbers to this high level of accuracy, they immediately saw that these DFT methods were, they weren't great, but they were usefully accurate. And overnight, all of chemistry changed to using DFT as opposed to hating it before. Well, they still hated it, but they started using it, right?
Nice.
But it was that point that caught, and so that was really boring work that very few physicists would have been interested in doing, a very meticulous work. But it was the existence and the knowledge of the exact numbers for those things that made all the difference. I just mentioned this, right?
Yes, so that kind of nicely brings me to the second point on my list, which was, you know, what would be your comments about standardized benchmarks, about open software, about reproducibility in the context of physics and machine learning?
So this is a hobby horse of mine. So I'll you think about what you want to say. So high energy physics, unlike astrophysics, is not a field that's been traditionally making the data open. We've had the data has been closed. The idea is it's too complicated for anyone else to understand, and various other reasons about experiments trying to cross check each other and things. But there's been a long discussion about, do we want to change that? How would we change it? How would we go about it? But there's a lot of, the move in terms of software being open is very, very useful. And that is, there's not really a lot of pushback there. And it's really accelerated things a lot. There's also been a lot of effort to try to sort of increase the incentives for people to create these kinds of open data sets like you talked about, because they're so valuable. And we've seen, we've organized within particle physics a few of these big challenges, partially just to try to popularize a thing and to try to make some connections with the field. But, so there's like a Higgs challenge and some tracking challenges that have been run through Kaggle and things like that. The challenges have been good for as a PR effort. But oftentimes we have to simplify the problem so much to be able for other people to understand them that they haven't been so useful in practice. So in this example that you gave, that somehow it's very crisply defined and like the target is very clear and et cetera. So finding the right balance of something that's useful and kind of easy to communicate so that people can, is difficult, and that's part of the balance. But one of the things that we've also done recently is try to build some infrastructure to make this easier. So I'll actually advertise a product that's being made now called Rihanna. It's being developed partially at CERN, but the idea is that if you have a scientific workflow that might involve a lot of people in some kind of collaborative, multi-step chain, which is what we encounter in high energy physics, that you can take the software associated to each one of those steps, which might be done by a different graduate student or postdoc at different places around the world, and we use the kind of cloud-based Docker technology to containerize those different steps. And then we can deploy these very complicated workflows onto like cloud-based infrastructure. And if you can do that, we were doing that to try to address the reproducibility issues in high energy physics, but you can have this much more reproducibility always seems very backwards looking. Like you didn't trust what I did, but there's this other, the same technology allows you to do something very forward looking. And so so one of the things that we're trying to do is also oftentimes some algorithm is not just used to solve one particular task, it's used for many different tasks. And to try to build kind of a heterogeneous set of different tasks that you might want to solve, where some tool, like some DFT calculation or some machine learning or some, you're trying to solve some puzzle piece, you can provide your solution to that and be able to use it in multiple different contexts and try to see, how well it's working. So I think that there's a lot of, a lot of people are very excited about seeing how, to have these kind of updated leaderboards and to try to have a consistent set of benchmarks that are updated. And so I think it's nice to see, and there's starting to be a lot of infrastructure that's being built to support that. So I hope that in the mm-hmm. coming years, that's much more common. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I guess on the topic of reproducibility, so I'm not sure in my field and sort of, numerical solutions for strongly correlated physics, if there's sort of reproducibility crisis per se. I think I guess especially when we're always comparing variational energies and so on. I mean, basically what you're trying to do is reproduce other people's, you know, best variational energy or whatever it is, or, you know, find the ground state of some strongly correlated model. So I think it's sort of maybe a less of an issue in our field. I'm not, you know, open software and so on isn't, it's not my crusade in principle. I understand the concept of open science, but I also believe in, you know, keeping things light and being innovative, and especially on the algorithmic side of things. I will say on the point of kind of a standardized data sets, we are starting to mobilize a little bit to get some sort of standard data sets for machine learning purposes in principle, and Everett Van Nieuwenberg right there is leading this effort for us, and so if you're interested in that, talk to him.
Mostly just agreed with Kyle. Yeah, I mean, it's a little interesting to think about what would be standard data for condensed matter, but maybe I could just add that I think a really good use that I'd like to see more of is, like, really, I see a lot of really creative young people applying machine learning tools to data for, like, model systems, you know, some kind of lattice model, and they're doing, like, these creative and kind of heroic things with that. But, you know, I think it'd be really great if they would start talking more to experimentalists, because then there's some, like, real data where there may be really a question of what process produced the data, and where the machine learning has a lot of leverage because it can sort of deal with disorder and noise and other things like that. So that would, and this is already happening, but I mean, that would be, I would just encourage everybody to go and do that, and that might be a really good opportunity to produce some kind of standard data in the field of condensed matter.
Okay, so, well, I think it's, for example, especially in statistical physics, we still have a lot of work to do to have open software. And there have been real, I mean, it's real big case, big fight, for example, to explain, for example, yeah, I think 2 years ago, about the phases of water, and at the end, it was not a big fight over physics, it was just a bug in one of the code, and the code was not available for 3 years. So, and I mean, is this just one example out of many? We don't have this, let's say, tendency, which is a good tradition that comes from, let's say, computer science, machine learning. You do a paper, you use the code, you publish the code, everybody can use it and can check. I think it's coming, but we are still a bit far, and we should do it.
So I'm also all for open software. However, I learned in chemistry there's a long tradition of creating small companies to sort of sell a code. And from a physics point of view, this is a bit sort of, you disdain this a bit, right? And it becomes proprietary, and there's all sorts of problems with that. However, there is one advantage, because for years the chemists were ahead of physicists in this regard, which is the company that you make is usually, say, 24 people. A few of them are PhD scientists, but most of them are sort of computer engineers of various kinds that they spend their days making the code easier for users to use without having to be PhD scientists in the particular area. And some of these companies are for profit, some are non-profit, but you know, they sell their codes at high prices to industry and usually highly discounted prices to academics. But our push toward open software, you know, also has had a sort of slightly negative effect. Say if you're getting money in the US on a grant, if the stuff is going into a proprietary code, that becomes an issue. So I would say there's room for both, right? But it has to be proprietary with these small companies, because they need to sell their product to industry, which is paying the salaries of the people who are making it more accessible. And for decades, physicists didn't understand this principle. And it isn't that the company's making lots of money, it's that you need to pay people, because you can't go get a PhD in physics by developing a good GUI for some piece of the electronic structure code.
Thanks. So next point on the list is publishing. Where do we publish physics and machine learning? Is it an issue? Is it easy?
I'm kind of curmudgeonly about this.
My opinion's a little bit bespoke. I don't know.
Let's hear it.
Well, start.
I don't know. I mostly let my collaborators decide that.
Okay.
Yeah.
What if you write a paper alone?
Yeah, remember.
I don't know. Once it's on the archive, I feel like I published it. But I feel like my opinion will be at the valid one maybe like 10 years from now. But right
give
now,
him the micro.
I'm a little on the head of the curve. So.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think there's a, there, you know, I agree with the point that, you know, I'm tenured now. In some sense, I don't really care so much anymore. But the but there's also a lot of people that are, you know, that I'm working with that are trying to build their careers. So that obviously does matter. And when you're going to, so we have to, you know, we can't just sort of laugh it off. There's also I think for the things in the crossroad where it's really it's a problem that I've tried a few different models that have been succeeded and failed in different ways. I've tried to write papers that are about the machine learning and the physics problem, and you end up with the kind of Venn diagram of people that understand the different things, which is very small, and they don't get into the physics journals or into the machine learning conferences because no one understands the paper. And then I've tried to sometimes successfully to write the machine learning abstraction paper, and then to use it, and then to have a separate paper that's it in practice. Sometimes that's been successful, but one of the recent ones that we did, the papers came out sort of simultaneously, and the machine learning journal was like, oh, this is already in the physics paper, so it got into some argument about is that we were very clear about the two, and so in the end, the machine learning group that got pushed up to the area chairs and all sorts of things. They're like, this is great, it should, you know, it's impactful, but it's not with some policy, so we're not going to accept it. And so now there's a problem that no machine learning person is going to be able to read the physics paper, you know. And so it's on the archive, so in some sense maybe it doesn't really matter, but at the same time for people, you know, it does matter. So there's the different communities are not used to this work that's sitting at the boundary, and especially there's, I think, both communities feel like if it's a physicist doing it, it can't be like a real machine learning progress because, you know, physicists don't really know what they're doing there or something. And I think that that's, you know, not always the case. And then vice versa, you know, on the physics side, we have a lot of physics journals that are denying those papers because they're like, oh, that's not physics. So like we people need to wake up and kind of, you know, either we need a new journal or we need some other kind of approach. I don't know. Also, I'll just say that in the machine learning side, it's right now the problem is it's so overly saturated. You have like thousands and thousands of papers being submitted for a conference, and the mindset of the review process is a filter. It's about getting rid of as many papers as possible as quickly as possible, and then only selecting the ones that are kind of the most high profile, whatever, you know, thing of the day, which is very fashion, you know, whatever's fashionable at the time. And then there are very few outlets for journals and computers and machine learning, and that, you know, and they're very competitive also. So where does all the stuff that's correct, that's impactful maybe for a domain but not fashionable for the machine learning community, where does that get published? I don't know of the venue for that right now. So I think that's a real hole in the publishing model currently. Yeah, I'll just add that one topic that's been really hard to publish anywhere are tensor network algorithms, so something I work on quite a bit. And but I mean, really, so it's like something that's not considered physics or computer science or math, basically. Although it is all of those things, but no community considers it part of their community that much. Or if it's in physics, you have to really decorate it with a lot of physics. Like, you know, you have to make it quantum, even though it may just be some kind of linear algebra technique. And then similar, if it's in computer science or in math, you have to put theorem and proof in places, even though the statements are true, you have to say theorem is true, you know, rather than just saying it's true. So anyway, I'm making a website just to hold all these algorithms. And so it's kind of not a journal. And it's not really a review article, it's just some kind of other thing. So maybe that's a direction we could go, would be to create some kind of community resources. I think there's already also some platforms that are trying to do this. There's this one called like Authoria that is trying to do this. So it's something kind of between like a wiki page, a blog, a journal, you know.
And there are people listening. Yeah, and there are people as well. Yeah.
if you go down that route, what I'll say is that you want something that can issue these digital object identifiers, because that's like what the publishing industry uses for tracking all the publishing. And if you want to be able to build the incentives and the infrastructure so that people, when they're going up for tenure, you can say like, here's whatever, and here's how many times I've been cited, or how, I mean, so we were doing this around code and data. We can, you know, can we attach these things to code and data, and we're getting the literature system in our field to track them and to cite them, so they're first class citizens. And the, so it requires like some organization to say, dear, you know, field, let's organize and build the infrastructure and the incentives to make this happen. And there's, there are now some, a few examples of very, very low cost journals that are basically, you know, plug into the whole publishing industry's, you know, stuff. And then they have like overlay journals, they're called archive overlay journals, where you have, you know, here's the thing, and then you can have people comment on them and different kind of review systems. There's a bunch of different models for how to build these things, but you can do them very cheaply without Elsevier charging you out the wazoo. And stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the big problem, is how do you incentivize people spending their time adding content to these things and tracking? Yeah, exactly.
So, I have no strong opinion.
So, but I guess if we use machine learning tools to do physics, I would say that we should publish in physics papers. So I mean, the idea is also having, I mean, the most, I mean, as really have a lot of impact. So again, if you use machine learning tools to do new physics in physics journal, then if you use physics to understand things in machine learning, I think we should really try to publish in machine learning papers. So if creating something else would be maybe, I mean, it's, if it's needed, in a certain sense, it's a little bit of a failure, in the sense that there have been not. So for example, just to do a parallel in economy, physicists or other people have tried to have an impact, and their method were orthogonal to the one of mainstream economics. And at the end, it was so difficult to get the attention of economists that they had to create new journals, like quantitative economics, or other journals like this. But then still, I mean, it's difficult for them. They start to, I mean, the people start to listen to them, but it's not a success story for the moment. So I guess if we can just publish in machine learning paper, that's the best thing. Then if we, if at a certain point, I mean, it comes out that we have, we can say things that are in ways that are not accepted, so we don't want to put the theorem, but we can say things that are really important and we think are really important. If it's not accepted, then maybe one should think about create new journals. But I think this would be option number two. It's not option number one. The best thing is to publish where all people in machine learning are publishing.
This morning I highlighted one of these papers that we did, particle in a box demo, and we got it into Physical Review Letters, which was nice. So then we wrote a long follow-up paper where we changed the kernel, tested lots of things about the methodology, so quite a long paper. I think I have on my computer somewhere between 10 and 12 referee reports for that paper. They're roughly divided in two. Half of them say, well, I hate this machine learning, so this paper is garbage, right? The other half would say, oh, this is really good, you know? But when we sent it to a physics journal, but there is no physics here, right? Because we were laying out all the methodology. So then, okay, well, we'll send it to a chemistry journal. Where's the molecule? Right, this is a particle in a box, right? So we eventually found a place to put, I had never had this experience before, but we really had something of the order of a dozen referee reports. So it really is difficult when you're between two cultures of where to put things. I do have some younger friends more sort of in computational chemistry, but they've created a journal of exactly this type, because they're dealing with the issues, and it's called, unfortunately, the Living Journal of something or another, which sounds bio, but it isn't bio. The living is the fact that you can update the paper and you get your DOI and they have a real editorial board and all that kind of stuff, but all those features. And it isn't like we're short journals, right? but there does seem to be a gap there. And, you know, what do you do when your physics, your usual physics base is just say no, right?
Exactly. That's the experience we had, is that some referees wouldn't even say whether something was good or bad. They would just say, what is this?
Yeah, it's not physics.
And, right. And we're like, well, do you like it or not? And they were just, you know, what is it? You know, and so I'm just putting stuff on a website now instead. But, you know.
Right. but you have a job.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a luxury. But I mean, I'm not trying to sound that, like, anyway. But just trying to say that, because these are things that wouldn't, these are like small things. Like, they're not even worth the paper sometimes.
Some of the things I'm talking about, they're just like little ideas or like little pieces of algorithms, but they just need to be written somewhere. So, you know, so sometimes there's things that are not quite a paper, but we just need a place to put them. So it'd be nice to create platforms for that.
One other thing on the reproducibility issue. So I think all the work I talked about was done with computer scientists. Reproducibility has been a bit of an issue. Just getting them to write out exactly what was done in the calculation, it has been very difficult. The culture is, well, here's the algorithm, and we ran it on a bunch of stuff, and here are the results. And if the algorithm is good, it'll be used by other people, and it will show that it works. But in quantum chemistry, for example, right, you put in all the numbers so that somebody can actually reproduce the numbers in the paper. And I spent half my time on writing these papers trying to get people simply to say precisely what it is that they've done. And I find that there's a cultural issue there, a big cultural issue.
Thank you. So my last item on the list before opening it to the audience is teaching and curricula of physics. Like, shall we adjust curricula of physics students to include some machine learning? Shall we try to teach some physics to other data scientists, because maybe we think it has some use to it? What do you think?
Are we talking about undergrad or?
Any. From preschool to graduate.
Well, probably undergrad's where it becomes important, because in physics. And do all undergrad institutions have computational physics as a required course? Just starting from computational physics, I'm not even sure. I think that's a good first step anyway.
So at NYU, we now have this Center for Data Science, and there's a master's program there, and we just started a PhD program. And oddly, the last thing we're adding now is the undergraduate program. And one of the things that's interesting there was that there are a lot of domains, like physics and, chemistry, biology, neuroscience, where there's a lot to be gained by having these deep connections with that, with the kind of data science-y, set of tools. A lot of those communities are, are policing their borders of what you call physics versus what you call, which is basically what we just were talking about in terms of the journals. So I tried at one point to create some kind of joint master's physics program. And from the physics side, there was a lot of pushback, because that's not physics. But it was very easy to create a specialization of a sort of physics track in the master's and the Center for Data Science. So we now have and right after we did it, there was like zero objection. It got approved through the university and all of the things you have to do. And immediately it was copied by biology and et cetera. So now our master's program has, you can partner with people. So you take some classes in, quantum information or quantum computing and some machine learning things, and you specialize in this area. So so I think, there are all these kind of organizational, boring, bureaucratic issues that have to be overcome, but they're important. On the undergraduate side, when I've taught the intro experimental courses, there's a part where you're actually doing experiments, and another part where it's like about how you analyze data and do some basic statistics. That's been done in the very physics-y way of doing it, and I've started trying to update that curriculum to look more like some statistics concepts and more aligned with some what's going on in data science and things. And I think generally there's also just the statement that even is happening here is that we have so much jargon in all of our sub fields that it becomes very difficult to talk to each other. And I think that pushing a little bit on all of us to become more fluent in statistical language and some precise, you know, language, and also some of the machine learning languages, allowing us to be able to communicate much more effectively, and so across, you know, within our domain and also across domains. So I think there's a part of the education which is also just about language and maybe starting to adopt some of these kind of some lingua franca, which is maybe starting to develop in the machine learning and statistics and data science areas. You can start to talk to lots of people on an airplane about, like, you know, VAEs and GANs and stuff like that. It's crazy, right? So we should take advantage of that, and like all the connections between free energy and et cetera and elbows and all this. Like we should be thinking about it, I think, about how we restructure our curriculum that way.
One thing I will say is when we tried to attract master's level students into sort of computational condensed matter, you know, courses in the past, there's only a small sort of fraction of incoming students that would even consider that. Now that we basically teach courses, or a course developed by Lauren Hayward-Searns, if she's here, and Juan and others, more from the machine learning perspective, we're getting a lot more young people interested in computational physics, let me put it that way. So I think you'll see a change in sort of the demographic of how we even approach this problem going forward.
Yeah, I would just echo what they both said and say that when I did some teaching last year, I mentioned machine learning as a big component of the, it was like a 1 week course that I taught, and I used it as one of the topics of one of the days, and I think that significantly drew more interest to everything else I had said. People, you know, said, oh, this could be used for machine learning, I'm even more interested in it. So that was good. So I mean, I think it's just, you know, good to sort of, whatever people are interested in, you know, speak to that. And then more concretely too, just to send the message to people that, so, you know, many people with a physics background will end up working in private companies, and this is great. And so to tell people that, hey, your skill set is preparing you to work in machine learning, like a lot of things you're learning can be transferred, and start to help people to make that transferal, like things like Kyle said, just about speaking the language even. So, you know, we could probably help people with that and connect them to people in industry and help them make those connections.
So, yes, I mean, I also agree. I think it's really in the undergraduate studies in physics, I think there should be an extra course for everybody about machine learning. So roughly, there is one course on computational physics in which we do Monte Carlo, differential equation, these kind of things. And it's not, I mean, you cannot think to put also machine learning in the same course. There should be two, and I think this what's going to happen generically. So for example, Adi Colomar, where I'm the head of studies, this is what we're going to do, and well, I think it's the natural direction to go. Now for the physics courses for, let's say, computer scientists, then I think it's certainly an interesting experience, but I cannot tell the two computer scientists they really need to learn physics. I think it would be good, but...
Jalekan said that at his webpage there were students asking him if they want to do machine learning a part of math and statistics and computer science, what should they take, and he said statistical physics. I was very happy, but I don't know how widespread that opinion is.
In our graduate program, I guess we've just started running David Kirby, who's an astronomer, is teaching machine learning as a general part of physics. And a good strategy is often either to have a program that's outside the department, or if it's within a physics department, you try not to call it physics, because that engenders this back reaction of, well, this isn't physics, right? So you try to keep it under the radar a bit. And one other thing is, Klaus, Robert Mueller, and I met at a math institute. And I've been finding that math is often this more universal language, right? When people are talking across disciplines, theorists, if you can turn it into a math problem, then most people can recognize it even though they're from a different field. And that helps an awful lot with bypassing the jargon. Yeah.
No, you should keep this one. There is one more microphone in the audience. So now we can turn the next questions to questions from the audience. I hope in the meantime you thought of some. So who wants to start? There. Titus.
No, I'd be interested to hear to what extent you think this is a paradigm shift in the way science, I mean, the scientific method is actually done. I mean, we hear a lot of, you know, there is skepticism in applying machine learning because, you know, there is a question of interpretability, especially for physicists. There's the question, is this actually an exact answer? It's all probabilistic. So, but of course, it opens a lot of possibilities as well. So, on what level do you think is this sort of a paradigm shift, or is it just another tool like a Fourier transform is, or, you know? So I would be interested to hear that. So of course, I look into future, so nobody knows. Yeah.
Just one really quick comment about, you mentioned interpretability, and I think that could mean a lot of things, though. It could mean maybe this extreme idea of like you open up what you learned and that you see Maxwell's equations inside or something like that. I mean, that would be, and you could, you know, make this happen. There's been some papers about that. But it could also just mean maybe that you use the tool the same way every time and it always gives the same results if you use it a certain way. Or, you know. So I think that we could, again, when you're running Monte Carlo, you don't maybe interpret every sample that comes out, but you know how you're generating the samples, something like that. So I think that maybe just as people use it more often, they can get comfortable with it, and that could be a kind of interpretability.
Yeah, so I think that it's a good question. I think a lot about this and trying to answer it for myself. One part is a lot of the focus on what we're doing with machine learning, where the successes are right now, for instance, happen in this kind of supervised learning-ish. And a lot of times there, the problem is very well posed, and you know, and you're basically saying, like, can I solve this task better than what I was doing before? And you know, not surprisingly, probably so, and we're seeing good successes there. Most of that I would not say rises to the level of doing like the scientific method and things like that. So there are people that do things like, can I try to figure out what experiment to do next where I'm going to learn more? And that starts to have the flavor of some kind of scientific method loop. And that's the kind of thing that's, but again, it's kind of still a planning decision-making process and you're doing it more efficiently than in a previous way. One thing about, to the extent that a lot of supervised learning, a lot of what we're doing is, you can be cast as a statistical problem. And then there's this idea of the like discriminative models and generative models. This idea, a generative model feels a little bit more like you can produce the data. It's closer to like what a physicist wants to do. But oftentimes, it's still very much in this very restricted context, right? So so physicists making predictions, we have generative models, but those generative models are also causal generative models, so that there's this kind of upper echelon, which is, so causal inference is kind of a bigger sphere of things that you can do than statistical inference. And so the thing that I think is really interesting is, as a particle physicist, we have people that, you know, point telescopes at the center of the galaxy and they see something and they're like, oh wow, that's weird. I should expect to see this at the Large Hadron Collider, right? Like, that is not a statistical thing, right? There was not like a bunch of training data that made some correlation between those two. We have a deep, you know, causal generative model that says how to relate these two things together. So this is the kind of forefront of a lot of what's going on in AI right now, is like, how do you build this kind of causality and these ideas of like common sense and, you know, what caused what? And it's really it's a level above like statistical stuff. So anything that looks like correlations and pattern matching and fitting is not going to be taking you to this like bigger level of science, you know, like paradigm shifts in science. So we have to figure out how to kind of bootstrap that kind of causal stuff. And there are some ideas of where you start to see, you know, little bits of that, but we're not quite there yet.
So I think in our field, we kind of already have a toolbox that we use to attack problems. Like, you know, we have DMRG, quantum Monte Carlo, VMC, exact diagonalization. And the worst case scenario, I think, is that machine learning becomes another tool that we use all the time, type of thing, right? I think the best case scenario is, like you're saying, there's some either a paradigm shift in how we do research, or we solve one of the holy grails in our field, you know, with some type of algorithmic advance that came from either data-driven, you know, learning or some type of machine learning like that. But I think in our field, it's not clear sort of which way the pendulum is going to swing there.
You're saying that like, the worst case is still pretty good?
Yeah, the worst case is great.
Yeah,
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and just to say, if we're not happy with the machine learning tools that we have, or if we have qualms about them, I mean, one thing we could do more is build better tools. Like physicists have an opportunity. We have really, we have lots of interesting and complex, but also clean data that we understand the process that generated, and we could study it more and then build tools that do give the right interpretation. So I think that would be a neat thing for physicists to do more.
So, well, my point of view is that it's certainly a tool. I wouldn't say that it's a paradigmatic shift, but it's a little bit more, I mean, it has the potentiality of being a bit more than just a tool, in the sense that, for example, in the example that I gave before, when you have a liquid close to the glass transition, you see, I mean, you can simulate it, but you don't understand why the dynamics is so slow. Now, if you have a model, I mean, for example, a deep network that is able to predict the long-time dynamics, it's clearly not discovering Newton equation. It's just finding what are the good features in the initial condition that are make the network able to predict. So from this point of view, then, if you go back and you try to understand what the deep network picked up as important feature, then you can build a theory starting from this. So it's a little bit more than just a tool, just not a numerical simulation from which you don't understand. It can help you to create new models.
I think it does represent a paradigm shift. The term paradigm shift, I guess, comes from Thomas Kuhn's study of quantum mechanics, 1900 or 1901. Planck mentions his constant, and it isn't until 1926 that people have the Schrodinger equation. So that's 26 years, which is a fairly decent career at the time, right? In which people did lots of quantum mechanics, but without the Schrodinger equation. I think we're seeing the start of what will ultimately be a paradigm shift. And you can see it, of course, it may be harder to see in traditional physics, but when you go across a whole bunch of disciplines, and what it's doing is it's changing the kinds of questions you can ask because of the way you sort of process the data. And I think we're seeing the start of it, and it'll take a while, but by the end, it will be sort of totally embedded in all areas of physics, and it will have changed a lot of the questions that people ask. That's just my opinion.
So I agree with that point. One thing that I think is interesting is that there are a lot of things that are happening now where the formulation, like when you explain it to like a physicist, it's like, you know, they're maybe skeptical about the machine learning things, and you explain it, you start understanding, and you're like, oh, but that's just whatever, and you're like, oh, it looks like a, you know, variational, how is that different than, and you're like, well, exactly, it's not really, in some sense, the principle is basically the same, but one of the things that's happening is that the level of our ambition is getting so much bigger. Like before, you would have said, like, well, let me just come up with a 100 million parameter model that describes my system, and I'll just optimize it and whatever, and da-da-da. You're like, you'd be like, yeah, sure, right? You know, but like, that's what we do regularly now, right? So somehow the level of ambition to be able to think about this path of how you might go about doing it is very different. And that, I agree, has this paradigm shift element to it. And also in terms of like the history of statistics, right? There's like this idea at the very beginning of writing out like, you know, basic axioms of probability and things, then all the first examples were things that you had to either be able to integrate or optimize with a pencil and paper, right? So that's why you have all the simple distributions that are named after dead people. And then there was this period where I don't know how to integrate it, and I don't know how to optimize it, but first you got numerical optimization algorithms for a likelihood that you could put on a computer. Then there was MCMC to be able to integrate them. And I think that one of the next rung of that is really this kind of likelihood-free technique where you have a simulation. You don't have to have a simplified likelihood function. You can put in your all the details that you know of the forward model of the simulation, which typically has a totally intractable likelihood, but now with the machine learning techniques, you're actually being able to turn it into a surrogate that allows you to do statistical inference, where your likelihood model is really like your full-blown description of everything, right? And that's a pretty serious step up the rung of things that we can do. So I definitely put that in the paradigm shift category.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Okay. Ladies first.
Okay, so you've been touching on this concept that you hear from a lot of people, like this is physics and this is not physics, right, for provocations and for a lot of things. But I was thinking about the question of teaching, but more in an in-reach sort of perspective. I mean, it's obviously, we do better as a field if we don't make that distinction, right? I mean, at least in particle physics, I've seen like the pushback that you have to first demonstrate, you know, against sometimes when pushing these algorithms. It's obviously an advantage if we're on the same page and we keep the talent that can apply these algorithms and come up with better things and better things instead of flushing it out to industry, is the way I see it. What do you do from your subfield, and what do you think we can do better to have a more informed community, like in physics, that, you know, ideally doesn't either doesn't create an artificial separation or encourages the use of machine learning being, you know, something that is a basic thing that physicists should understand and that we can do a lot with.
Yeah, thanks for the question.
Yeah. So my understanding of the question is basically how can we recognize that these are valuable and try to remove this kind of artificial barrier between the kind of the physics side and the people that were the us and them mentality of the, is that correct?
I guess, yeah. How have we already, and how can we still do better?
I mean, I think part of it is that's where maybe the success stories start to matter, is that, you know, if you look at areas like, on the like human genome project and things like that, you know, you have these people that were, you know, bioinformatics and all these kinds of fields where that was critical, and then all of a sudden they demonstrated their worth to the, and then now they're, you know, now you don't have a hard time getting tenure and there's whole departments and et cetera. So we don't yet have quite as many examples of that on the physics side. I mentioned this master's program at NYU, part of that is you saw so much pushback about trying to create the, from one side, but the hope is that by bringing in people into the department from the kind of data science side that partner with, you know, professors that have projects and things like that, and they demonstrate how useful these skills are, that then it will be like, oh, well, maybe we shouldn't have such, maybe we should just have them kind of in-house, and it will start to erase this. But it's going to, I don't know, I think that's going to go organically and slowly. It's very hard to, you can try to stimulate it, but it's hard to force it, I think.
Yeah, I guess I would just add, you know, maybe it's too late for us, we're already too old, but for all the young kids coming up through, you know, the system now, I think we can remove these artificial barriers and you know, they will, I already see it now with the young undergrads and master's students who work with us. I mean, they don't see a separation necessarily between computational, you know, I guess, techniques or computational ideas and physics, right? So, I mean, the way we teach it has some sort of historical bias, but I think, you know, if we erase that, you know, more and more, then the new generation will fix that problem for us.
I agree. Yeah.
Okay. There was one more question. Yeah.
Yeah. So I have a question, just like in about the maybe just general validity. Theoretical foundations of like machine learning, it is statistics, and you know, it's like a ABC theory that just basically tells you like what are the guarantees what are the guarantees for the generalization of your model? However, all of these like guarantees are basically for interpolation problems. So like in physics in general, you know, we are very interested in also like exploring new possibilities, something that was not in the data. So how do you see like this gap? Is there like a way of solving this problem, or if not, like then how should we actually treat you know, machine learning for physical applications?
I mean, just a brief comment is that I do think it would be worthwhile to make other, you know, types of machine learning models that could be specifically tailored for certain goals that physicists may have, that may be different goals from what people in industry may have. Like, I think sometimes people conflate machine learning with neural networks, but I think it's like far from clear that you know, a lot of the success is coming primarily from neural networks. Like, it could be coming from just having more data, just trying things people just didn't try before with better software and GPU cards. And, you know, so I think we should kind of, you know, like Kieran did a lot of work just using kernel methods, and it worked quite well in his domain and gave a lot more understanding about the validity of the methods they were using. Maybe it's not exactly to your question. But.
Well, yeah.
So, like, machine learning, you know, if you don't have good data, you cannot do good machine learning. So, like, garbage in, garbage out. But the problem is so you have some data set, you have some data, like, but what you want to do is you want to have some model that can generalize and look like outside of your data set, like usually. Like, for example, in doing these DFT calculations, yeah, like, you, of course, you can create a lot of simulations, but probably, like, for, like, you know that machine learning algorithms, yeah, they're very expressive. So it's probably not a very big surprise that, you know, that your test data, like from the same data set, is small. But what if you want to use like the same models for something that, you know, the algorithm didn't see?
So a quick story is I once upon a time gave a talk at NEC, and I had the pleasure of meeting Vladimir Vapnik, and I was reading his books, and I was trying to understand, I thought it was very beautiful, and I was trying to understand, you know, this VC dimension, which characterizes the capacity of some model, right? And for like support vector machines, that's not small, and for neural networks, it's very large. And I was trying to understand, you know, physical theory. So the standard model has, you know, 23 parameters. So I have a model with 23 parameters that explains, you know, it's consistent with several decades of experimental results, right? So that. So I was trying to understand, like, what is the VC dimension of the standard model? Can I calculate that? Right? Why not? You know, it's a model, it predicts things, it's generative. And I was trying to wrap my head around that question in particular. And in that process, I started realizing that, oh, you know, actually it's much bigger than that. It's not a statistical model for this particular context, because the standard model allows me to make predictions in all these different contexts, right? So the level that's a model is you take the theory coupled with a particular context, right? I have the theory and at the LHC, or the theory and some underground experiment, and the theory and if I point my telescope into space. So it's a richer construct. And that's where what I would point you to there is really this idea of causal inference, which is a rung above, you know, statistical things. And that's what I think that we kind of take for granted as physicists. We sort of we love causality, it's built baked into everything. But in terms of our language about how we talk about it, I think that's kind of one of the big missing ingredients. And you know, ironically, I think most physicists can tell you basically almost nothing about causal inference in terms of like how you understand, you know, how do you figure out those, because we have such a strong causal model of how the data is generated that we just take it for granted because we kind of know what the causal model is. But if we want to couple this with a machine learning model that doesn't know, we have to figure out how to bake that same kind of stuff into it. And that's where these examples of like, you know, I see this, you know, I see this thing and I know what experiment to go to next because I'm trying to break the theory, right? So that's what I would point to, is this kind of causal inference is the missing ingredient.
So can you actually put like causal inference onto automatic, you know, regime?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So in causal inference, usually you posit what the causal model is, and then you can test it and various consequences of it. And that's where these ideas of interventions come in, like you mess with the system and you see how it responds. And if your causal model is correct, then it will respond like you predicted it does. But that's sort of like, you know, if I didn't know if my image is blurry because of like the atmosphere or the lens of my telescope or the galactic foreground or something like that, you know, I can intervene by messing with the atmosphere or messing with my lens and see how it responds, and I can check, right? So so that's where most of the causal inference is, that trying to actually learn the causal model itself is harder, but people are moving in that direction, and that's an area where like machine learning research is going, but it's that's a place where I think we need to invest. So in this kind of 26-year timescale of the paradigm shift, I think that's what we're gonna need if we want to start thinking about something that's like, you know, machine learning versions of physicists.
Somebody else wants to comment on that? I mean, if I, or, go on. I mean, if I may, to me, this kind of questions really reflects on what Miles said earlier, because it's a really great question. And I think it simply doesn't come up too often in the traditional machine learning applications, such as image processing and speech and things like that, right? But today, in three of the different talks, we heard about this active learning, like, oh, you have a training set, but if it doesn't predict well a certain new guy, then, well, you just run the DFT and you add it to the training set. Like, in machine learning, this is not the usual thing. You usually cannot, like, do that. Like, of course, some applications you can. But it's not, like, a central question. But in physics, it seems like to be a central question. And as Miles said, I mean, we should not be worried build the right machine learning for that kind of setting. And I agree with you that the theory that is there in like computational learning theory assumes that the data are coming to us IID from some distribution. But of course, I mean, most of it. But of course, if I do this active, this is completely breaking. So, you know, why don't we go and, you know, at least insist to our machine learning colleagues or math colleagues or for ourselves, you know, this is a great problem. We should just look at it and it should be known. And it seems to come up every day.
We can raise the standards, raise the bar. Right. That's all. Just to say that, you know, applying machine learning to physics doesn't have to just mean whatever TensorFlow does, can that help physics? Like, it could mean, like, you know,
plus hacks that we can think about or our PhD student can think about.
Kyle is, I think, saying, you know, sophisticated ideas from statistics that we could, like, borrow over and use fruitfully.
Last question over there, then we will move to dinner.
So online courses have helped a lot of people at different stages of their education and career learn machine learning. If you were going to make a first course on physics and machine learning, what would you like to see in it?
We do have that course online on at the master's level on the Perimeter Institute Records Archive, Piercer, whatever it's called. And we teach it from a StatMech perspective. Basically, we start with a Monte Carlo that generates, say, Ising model configurations, and which is kind of a standard paradigm in StatMech, you know, computational physics, and then use that as input to train, you know, feed-forward neural networks, you know, generative models, things like that. So we're producing the data with standard techniques, and then using machine learning techniques to analyze it. That's the approach I like.
I like to focus on statistics and then writing simulators for simple systems. People start getting used to the idea of, like, it's a very physics idea of writing a simulator for something, and you see in practice the statistical, you know, thing. You get all sorts of ideas of like Markov processes and blah blah. There's all, so it's very rich. It's a very good starting point.
Okay, in that case, you know, I think we can thank all our panelists because we are, you know, let's not get over time. I was reminded by Lars to keep on time, so let's keep on mind and thank them. And let me just give you a heads up. So if you looked at the program, you saw that there is a similar slot to the one today on Thursday, late afternoon. But it was discussion/open problems. So today was the discussion. And Thursday, we kind of, I assume for a physics conference, it's kind of an experiment. But like math conferences, they love it. They always do it with the open problem session. So in very much in the spirit of what Kieran was saying, that they met with, I forgot who, at the IPEM Institute, and kind of that the math language kind of, or environment kind of helped them to communicate. So I would hope to formulate our open problems, but try to, you know, present that as mathematically as possible, so that also people that are not like in your field can kind of understand them. So try to think about it. If there is like an open problem in your field that you want to, that you don't know how to solve, if you do, then you know, of course, you will write your paper in a year. So one that you don't know how to solve, that you want to share with the others, and it will be pretty much self-organized. You know, the idea is that people go to Blackboard, take, say, no more than 5 minutes to explain their problem, and then it goes like that. So I give you time to think, you know, to have few interesting problems come up of that. Okay, thank you everybody.